So again, what struck me in our beginning session check-in was how all of you are really working with your feelings and facing them and connecting to what you're experiencing of those of you that spoke. And I can assume that those of you who didn't speak are also having those kinds of mindful awareness of what is happening. And when usually we do that somatically, we can check our bodies and see how we feel, what we are experiencing in the moment, and then be able to try to find a few words. You know, I hate just using one word like anger. Try to find a few words that point to whatever is triggering us so that we can become more aware of the thought processes that brought us to this state of emotion. So that's what I want to talk about a little bit today in terms of anger. And of course, anger in terms of your placement and of your work in chaplaincy. That's really important. So it's the ninth precept. And I was thinking about, why is it the ninth precept? You know, why isn't it the first precept? Of course, I have struggled with anger all my life. I'm a complete expert on this for you. Why is it the ninth? And then I thought, well, actually, when you think about most of the precepts, they are talking about the actions that arise out of anger, right? Harmfulness, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct. I mean, in fact, so many of them arise out of our, and speaking about the others, slander and all of that arises out of hatred, of anger, as we call it. The way we phrase it is very simple. It's not being angry. But if you look at all of the different traditions and how they've translated it, most of them have something about holding a grudge, some quality of sticking. So it's not so much the emotion that arises, but of the holding and believing in what has arisen or the reasons for this emotion to having arisen. So also we could call it malice or ill will, rage. The actual characters are simply a Chinese phonetic translation of the Sanskrit. And the term is kupita, meaning antipathy or anger, pushing away. You know, it's the same phrase that's used in the three poisons of Buddhism, greed, anger, and ignorance. We're talking about the second one, anger. So there's greed, wanting, I want it all. Anger, I don't want any of it. And ignorance, I'm so deluded that I'm incapable of realizing that I am one with all other beings. So this anger is really at the core of Buddhist teachings. In the Zen Peacemakers, we added the phrase transforming suffering into wisdom. This is the precept of not being angry. So it's to acknowledge that there is suffering, our own suffering, and our response to the suffering of others, such as the example about Mexico, our response to the suffering of others. But does that become ill will, malice, rage, or does that become wisdom and skillful practice? So that's the key edge or pivot of this precept. Other Zen groups in particular have added phrases such as this is harmony, peace, equanimity, compassion, loving kindness, understanding. These are all the qualities that help us transform this emotion that we're having into something skillful that can be of use to others. So that particularly in the context of the work that you do in chaplaincy, how you are being aware of what's arising and working with it. Why is it arising in this way? Is this a blaming? What's happening to me physically, and what kind of thought processes have led me here, and how can I transform this into a skillful way of experiencing myself, my relationship to the others, and the situation as a whole? Our psychology, our Western psychology, a lot of it tells us not to repress our anger. We know that. And the Abrahamic tradition approves a prophetic voice, a righteous anger. So in this world that we live in, we can pump ourselves up and say, well, I'm really right about this, and therefore I have a right to be angry. And I think that can be confusing for Western Buddhists, because on the one hand, I have a right to be angry, and on the other hand, holding anger is an obscuration of pure mind and an unskillful way to behave in the world. I was thinking about that as I was walking over here, because it's not so clear all the time, because we grew up in this tradition, in this culture that approves of certain kinds of anger. Now I was thinking, well, you know, there's the models. I'm thinking of Dr. King, and I'm thinking of Gandhi, and I'm thinking of Mandela, and I'm thinking of people who have every reason in the world to have embraced a righteous anger, and how they have turned and become models and changed cultures that they lived in. Very much. What we experience in our in the hospitals, in the prisons, on the streets, is a lot of stress, a lot of suffering, disappointment, transference. Suddenly we become the repository of, you know, a person is just terror-stricken, upset, confused, disappointed, doesn't know who to go to, and you walk into the room. Perfect target. You can be perfect target. And your response to that, how does it arise out of the knowing that to give rise to a holding of anger is not the skillful way to work in the situation. When you're working with a client's or patient's or prisoner's anger, as the woman in the back talked about, how do you do that? We can only do it if we know how it is with us, if we can meet our own feelings completely and be able to see that, then we can do that with others. So the Buddhist view of anger is that no one really makes us angry, right? And no situation really makes us angry. But we're stimulated to experience this emotion by things that arise in our world that water the seeds of karma that are in us, so of our past. So we have these seeds of potential anger that are there. They're called internal formations, and we say they're in our store consciousness. Those are phrases that we use, but I mean, you can just completely understand that because of your life, this life, and the things that you've experienced in this life, there are all these triggers. Are they called seeds? We can call them seeds, or we can call them triggers. But there are all these potentialities for us to become enraged just by someone's words or expression or lack of expression. I mean, it's amazing how the smallest thing can trigger this in us, because it's like there's this readiness for that. So when something touches this seed of anger already present, then it arises, then it flourishes. So typically in Buddhist practice, as I understand it, anger is an obscuring emotion. It is something that imprisons us, forcing us to go down a path of thinking that feeds the anger and increases it and leads to unskillful behavior. So we can think of anger in different kinds of ways. We can just experience our anger, you know, when you stub your toe. And so there's no one really to blame in that moment, right? That maybe your partner should have moved the chair or something. But a lot of times there is no one to blame. You know, it's between you, your toe and the chair. And, you know, you're cussing or whatever. You feel stupid. It's kind of a loss of control. And you feel kind of stupid about that. And so that's kind of like the first level of anger. We become ashamed of it, this kind of outburst that happens. More typically, we become angry and we justify it. I'm angry and I'm right. And, you know, I have my whole religious tradition to prove I'm right, or my whole spiritual, ethnic group to prove that I'm right, or whatever. For me, in this day and age, that's the most dangerous form of anger, because you can't reach it. We can't reach it if we think we're right. We're stuck. We're imprisoned. So this is that indignation that comes under the voice of some sort of, you know, prophetic voice. I experienced that so much when I was a young person, politically. I had a lot of political anger, but actually it came out in very unskillful ways. And with my colleagues, it was really very unskillful. It just created more and more separation, inability to provide to find any way to make peace, find any way to harmony. It just kind of created greater and greater separation, and people become, you know, really isolated in their idea that they are righteous and they are true. So, I mean, this can certainly happen. Some of the people that come to see me and work in hospitals and talk about, you know, a nurse on the ward or a person that is a doctor that said such and such a thing, and it escalates, and it's the person in front of me is like completely hysterical about how they are completely right and this other person is wrong. Well, you can see there's not going to be any harmony, and you can just imagine what the collateral damage of that kind of righteous anger is for all those around, including the person who is the so-called victim, who is not being served at all by this person's anger. Another really powerful kind of anger that I see a lot is being angry and not knowing you're angry. Right? You know what that's like. And then it's just the slightest bit of dampness. You don't need anything to water your seed. just a kind of high humidity will let it blow, right? And we've all known ourselves in some kind to not be aware of a certain anger that's arising. So, you know, in that sense, to be aware of our I understand how it is to be mindful. It's really so much about tracking your body, really tracking somatically what's going on with you all the time. Even when you just hear a word, just hear a gesture, and say, oh, what was that? what was going on there? And then a little bit of curiosity, a little bit of investigation, you know, yields this wonderful, wonderful kind of opening of some place that's closed and blinding you and imprisoning you. So it's really, really important. And then the final kind of anger I just want to mention is our anger that's directed at ourselves. And a lot of times we're not aware of that self-directed anger, which can lead us to lots of very unskillful behaviors. So if you think about how it feels, there's this kind of sense of arousal. There's kind of, you know, they say that it's like you're preparing to attack someone. That kind of that sense. And in a way, it's kind of exhilarating, anger is. It's enlivening. Denying the anger can be the opposite. It can be a deadening feeling. So, you know, if you're really feeling tired and dead after an experience or an event, say where you're working or when you're putting your hours in, you're feeling really exhausted, it might be really good to look at exactly what happened during that day. When did that deadening feeling start to happen? Where can you track a little bit what was going on? Because when we put a cap on it without acknowledging it or seeing it, it just smothers. It smothers us and can just lead to this kind of this dead feeling, this apathetic feeling. There's some different theories about anger. One in neuroscience is that we observe something and then we have an appraisal, a quick automatic appraisal of what's happened, right? And then an evaluation, which, and all of this is happening within a couple of seconds or a second. I mean, this I'm talking about. You see something, you appraise what you've seen. You evaluate that, good or bad. You know, so you see something, you appraise it, what is it? And then you evaluate it, is it a threat, is it not a threat, is it good, is it bad? And then the emotion arises. So there is a classic metaphor in Buddhism about this that I love, because I see it in myself so often, and it's called mistaking a rope for a snake, right? And if you've ever done that, or if you've ever been out in the woods and seen, you know, or a branch of a tree or something, oh, it's just a rope. But how often have we seen a part of the picture in an experience with our friends, our loved ones, or our patients, or our clients, and we have appraised it incorrectly and have allowed ourselves to take that little bit of information, just, you know, a little bit of data, not a lot, and let it go into these well-worn pathways in our minds. Or you could say, karmically wrought pathways in our minds. And we build a story. We build a story right then. This is what happened, and that blah, 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 blah. And it's all based on this one bit of data. She's late. She's disrespecting me. I know that person has never respected me. It's just like my mother. Wait. Actually, my watch has stopped, or is going too fast, or something. Right? That's the misperception. It's not really 10:15. It's really 10 o'clock. So that whole story was based on that misperception, and the stories can get really large and involved, and it was like that last year, and blah 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 blah. And these are our karmic obscurations that are there, and we've taken a piece of data and we've let it go into that place because we haven't been able to stop that process. And the key to stopping that process is our awareness. And the key to our awareness is our somatic awareness, is to use our body like a tuning fork. So I'm sure that this has been the teaching all the whole year, is when you walk into a room, your body is this tuning fork. And when you encounter this feeling of anger, you can step back. You can use your ordinary intellect. The other things I'm talking about are kind of automatic parts of our biology. But we do have our mind to say, is this true? Did I interpret this correctly? Does this feel a little familiar? This story? To step back and have a kind of wider, more spacious curiosity about the event. Is this person that's screaming at me not even actually seeing me at all, but just screaming because they're so upset and they're so out of control? Is this nurse that is being so rude to me really not even knowing that I'm there? She's in a life that is so filled with suffering that it has nothing to do with me. But I am taking it on, and I am angry, and I'm beginning to rage. And now we're going to have this meeting of rages upon rages, right? But there are alternatives. In one of the oldest Buddhist phrases from the Dhammapada, this is often quoted. He abused me, he struck me, he overcame me, he robbed me. In those who harbor such thoughts, hatred will never cease. He abused me, he struck me, he overcame me, he robbed me. In those who do not harbor such thoughts, hatred will cease. So in this phrase, it's really focusing on how we use our minds. And also I want to point out, it's the harboring. We have this natural capability of power and energy when something arises, but we don't have to act on it. We don't have to hold it, and we don't have to believe it. And we don't have to be ashamed of it. When we can become so free as to know exactly what's going on with us, you can even have a sense of humor about these raging feelings that we may have. The idea is not to harbor. And the second phrase in the Dhammapada that's important is, instead of using the term anger, using the term hatred, which frees us Westerners from some of the ideas we have about anger that we've picked up in Sunday school and in the therapist's office. So, because we can all agree that hatred is not a skillful way of being. And Shanti Deva, the wonderful, wonderful, wise teacher, said, and I used to laugh at this when I first began to practice many years ago, and it's so funny that how you turn around as you continue to practice and allow the practice to wear on you and wear on you. But he says that we really should thank our enemies because they give us a chance to practice patience. And on the surface, that can seem like a really absurd thing to say. But fundamentally, it's true that these experiences that we have, and I guess you all know that, or you wouldn't be in this course of training, because you are all willing to go into very difficult, uncomfortable situations. For many of you, the saddest of situations, where people are not skilled and not trained. It's not like you're all going into some monasteries where people have been practicing for 40 years about their death or the death of their loved ones or letting go. You're going into very difficult situations. And to be able to appreciate whatever it, karma it is that brought you there, and brought you to the point that you're willing to do this work, and to thank those that challenge you and allow you to go deeper and deeper in your understanding and your compassion. He says patience, that's in his chapter on patience, but I say it's all of the Buddhist virtues that we receive from those that assault us and those that challenge us. They're the ones that are essentially allowing us to cross over and to really take that in and know that. So one of the things that that does is it allows us to know ourselves better, and it's a kind of selfish thing that happens as you practice in your placements and in your life as you continue going forth working with people who are suffering. It's a kind of selfish thing, but what happens is that you begin to know yourself better, more able to drop the masks that you've created to protect yourself from reality, but to more able to drop in to your own nature, who you are. So when we practice in meditation, we only have a gross level. We know that I'm agitated or I'm sleepy, some of those kinds of things, or I'm tense. But in the kind of work that you're doing, your practice can be very refined. Your Buddhist practice can be very refined when you are working in these difficult situations with these difficult emotions, particularly with anger, with your own anger, your own reaction. So then you're right on that level where you are refining yourself so that you can better serve others. So as Shanti Deva says, this is the perfect time. So rather than feeling frustrated, we should be appreciative. It's hard to see that at first, but when you begin to experience it, and I'm sure many of you have already experienced that, it's like, wow, look how that worked out. Isn't that wonderful? So another basic Buddhist principle is when we begin to really observe a defilement, an obscuration, it loses its power. That it's just the quality of actually looking at it rather than turning your back on it. So it's not to say, well, that's over. Thank God that's over. I'm not going to think about that. I'm just going to think about all the great things that happened today. I'm only going to write about the great things that happened today. But really to examine that obscuration, that difficulty, that feeling, really to go deep into that, it will lose its power. It's really true. So the key is to create in yourself, in your body, a spacious container so that you can feel what you're experiencing, not deny it, but without creating further karma, by allowing it. So that is not repressing, and nor is it acting. But it's confronting our rage or our karmic suffering with this kind of intelligence that we have. You know, I mean, anger is the stupidest thing. I mean, it really is. When we act out, it's really stupid. We lose, you know, our IQ drops 50 points immediately. And this is like putting some intelligence into the situation, using the nature of mind. And when I say mind, I kind of point to my heart, because it's like it's the nature of your mind that is so connected to your body. So your body is like, what am I feeling? What is happening in the situation? But directed inward right away, so that you can take care of what your body is doing, and really be aware of that, and then use that intelligence back out to realize what is occurring with the people that are involved in the situation, or even the situation itself. So, I like to think of Suzuki Roshi's. Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, the San Francisco Zen Master's wonderful phrase that he said, you should rather be grateful for the weeds you have in your mind, because eventually they will enrich your practice. You should be grateful for the weeds in your mind. And I'm saying today that we should be grateful for the unskillful kinds of feelings that we have that arise that allow us to see that they are unskillful and allow us to look at those pathways. I mean, you know, we can be so paranoid. It's just the most amazing thing how we can create those stories that arise out of our own past. And to be able to catch them is incredible liberation. It's just wild to be able to see that in yourself. But it takes the kind of honesty that can only be achieved through, in my view, meditation practice and deep internal study, to really be willing to look at why these things are arising and not be stupid. So finally, that's what I'm saying to you about the precept of not being angry is don't be stupid. we have a little exercise. We have a break, a silent break. That's because, although I ended on a happy note, I would really like you to look during the silent break at your own personal experience of anger and how you feel about your anger and perhaps even allow some recent angry experience to arise. And then we'll come back and we'll do an exercise. Mm-hmm.